Seattle, Washington, May 28, 1980. This is side one, the second part of two tapes, an interview between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, Labor Research Specialist, University of Minnesota, Labor Education Service, and myself concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strikes of 1934.
Hello.
Okay. Listen, I have a 1 o'clock appointment, so I figure we should talk for about another half hour till about
1:30. Fine. 1:30. Anytime.
Okay.
Well, anyway, that's what I know about Grant up to that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked in the coal yard, down there at Fuel Distributors. Now, to my knowledge, he had no transfer experience, none in the general trucking field. And when the organizing in the coal yards was done, Grant was very active in it. And he right away quick become a close friend of Bill Brown's, buddy buddies. They liked one another, and they complimented each other. And this brought out Grant's more jovial nature, because Bill Brown was a fun-loving guy. You know, he could get a joke out of anything, and he was probably one of the best qualified agitational speechmaker I ever encountered. And that thought shared by many, not just me. So Grant was active in the organizing of the coal yards. Now, earlier I'd said that I didn't know that Grant ever owned a truck, and I'm sure he didn't. And the driving that he done was for something else. And because he was active in the organizing of the strike and its successful conclusion, Grant was one of the guys that, when the season started to warm up a little at the middle of February, was one of the first guys to feel the effects of getting laid off. And somewhere between the strike was over, started I think on the 4th and lasted 4 days. Oh, probably around the 1st of the March, shortly after there, Grant was more out of work than he was working. Now, you have to understand that at that time, when the city was heated by coal, and people would buy a ton of coal and they'd hope to get through on it, and if that didn't carry them through, they'd order a half a ton or even as much as 500 pounds, because first they didn't have a lot of money, and a lot of people were renting, and they didn't want to have any more coal in the basement than they actually needed if they had to move, and so on. So the work, even if the employers didn't want to get rid of the men, there was a slackness in the industry that guys could do better someplace else. Well, Grant was in that category, and he became then very active around the union. Now, between the meeting that we held at the Schubert Theater, which was somewhere in April, we used to meet every Monday, as I recall, or every other Monday. They had a organized what they call a volunteer organizing committee. And if memory serves me, Grant was elected secretary, or served. That was a kind of a pro tem thing. And I forget now who was all on it. Bill Brown, George Frozick, I was not. And I was not at the meeting when it was set up. And was probably working or out of the city. Had I been at that meeting, there's no question I would have offered my services. But I wasn't. It was volunteer. There was no money. And Grant played a very good role in that. And as I say again, he got very closely associated with Bill Brown. Now, Bill Brown was a paid official of the Teamster Joint Council, but he was also president of 574. So Grant played a very good role in the organizing, and Mickey as well. But Grant, I think, was, it strikes me, because if I remember right, Grant gave the report when we had the big meeting at the Schubert Theater. It was Grant who gave the report on the success of the organizing committee. And Grant had a hand in laying out the original plans. Now, at shortly after that, I think Mickey took over the secretary, because he was more active in the Jimmy Higgins work, and Mickey done later on. But I think at the beginning it was Grant. And probably the reason was that Mickey was a little more steadily employed than Grant. It was a question of those that have and those that have not. Well, Grant didn't have any work, so he was up helping out at the Union. Now, later on, as soon as Farrell was laid off, he got in the committee as well. And he got laid off sometime, I don't know, middle of March, first April, maybe earlier. I don't recall. Geez, hell, that's so many years ago, I can't remember. But I do know that them dudes were up in the hall all the time. You know, not in the hall sitting there, but I mean, they were around. Anytime you'd go to the Union Hall, you'd see one or the other. And they were all active as hell and trying to operate in spite of that goddamn load of dunnage at Cliff Hall, who was trying his best to sabotage everything. So Grant played a very good role there. And Grant was on the negotiating committee in the coal strike, as I recall. And he helped draw up some of the original demands that we were formulating. He was instrumental there. And by and large, he was an able guy that could fit in any place, and a guy that could kind of come in, you know, and grasp things without too much briefing. Mm-hmm. And usually was pretty accurate in his analysis of the thing.
Was he very involved in the strategy making?
Oh, yes,
for
yeah.
The coal driver's strike? And
yes, yeah, he was involved in that. I think he was they had a negotiating committee. And he was involved in it.
You mean for the coal strike?
For the coal strike. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that when Carl and he and Mickey, they were a close-knit group. The Dunn family in Skoglund, they were pretty close. And because of Ray's and Carl's inseparable political affiliation, and because of the closeness of the family. Now, I suppose that Grant, who probably was away from Minneapolis more than either Mickey or Ray, he wasn't involved in all that closeness during the period that Mickey and Ray and Carl were close. But when Grant come back, why, he involved himself pretty close in it. And there's no question to what degree in the strategy making. I suppose they sat around their homes in the evening and talked about what they would do and how they'd do it, and have those ideas to talk about with the men the next night or the next day in the Union Hall. And I'm sure Grant had a big hand in it.
Was Grant as political a person as his brother? As Ray in particular?
As Ray?
Yeah.
Well, he didn't have the same degree of activity. Mm-hmm. I think his thinking went the same way. Mm-hmm. But Ray is the one that was the more dedicated of all the Duns that I knew to his political belief. I'm not talking about Bill, who was a professional revolutionist and on the payroll of the Communist Party. I'm not talking about Bill. I'm talking about the ones that I knew intimately. Ray was the, I thought, the one that was more, well, how am I going to say, exponent of the political thinking outwardly. Now, there's no question that Grant and Mickey shared Ray's thoughts. They were very close. But Grant was not the guy that would sit down with you and talk about political things the way Ray would. Now, Mickey would talk with you, but he was more... Ray was the more theoretical guy. Mickey would involve the colloquial things, you know?
Yeah, at a more gut level. Kind
yeah, and Grant, of course, had it too. But Grant, Ray once told me, he says, you know, of all the brothers in the family, Grant's the smartest.
Hmm.
And some of the things that I see Grant do, it led me to believe that he had more than his share of smarts. But he wasn't throwing it around all the time. He wasn't a big braggart or anything like that. He was a kind of a soft-spoken guy, and but he was goddamn able. And he and Bill Brown, as I said, they struck it off good together. And
so did he and Bill Brown have a real close relationship, and they
were Oh, yes. They were like the brown stuff in the blanket. They were real close together, you know.
Was Ray more associated with Carl Skoglund?
Yes, yes. Over the years, you know,
mm-hmm.
Ray and Carl were, and, oh, there was a couple of other fellows around there. Was a railroad engineer and electrician. They were the mainstays of that political thinking group. Now...
Now, Carl must have been, or I shouldn't put the question that way, was Carl considerably older than Ray?
I think they were about the same age. There wasn't too much difference, as I recall. There wasn't too much difference. I'd say that Carl and Ray were both about 45 years old. And Bill Brown was about 40. And Grant and Mickey were close in that same bracket. See, Grant and Mickey weren't too far apart. Like I said, I don't know which was first or which was second. But I know that during the strike, during the first strike, Grant was on the committee. He was on the steering committee, on the negotiating committee. And they were, in fact, the titular heads of the union. They ran the show, so to speak, as far as the daily activities. The president of the union was Bill Brown, and vice president George Froese. And on that committee was Bill and Ray and Carl, Farrell and Mickey and Grant. And then many times George Froese would be there too. But the other members of the executive board were not on the committee. So those six or seven that I outlined to you were the ones that were closest to the men. Babe Nolan, Sammy Haskell, Essler, Bill Gray, and Mo Hork. They were not considered, although they were officers of the union, remember, elected officers of the union. They were not considered the leaders, in my opinion. And most of the men didn't recognize that, and I'm sure if you look around, you'd find the same thing was true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I gotta say this in support of Mo Hork. Mo, at first, was imbued with the old IBT theory, you gotta crawl before you walk thing, and he was supportive of Cliff Hall. But shortly after Mo saw what Cliff Hall stood for and what the other group stood for, Mo lined himself up in support of the other group and not in support of Cliff Hall. So it's to Mo's credit that he done that. Now, a couple of the other guys did not. Now, then during the strike and the critical days of the strike, Grant was there and played a good role. Grant was with Farrell when the headquarters was raided. I don't know where Grant was, if he was in the headquarters. He was in the headquarters. And so was Farrell, and so was Ray. Now, they nabbed Mickey and Bill Brown. They got them wherever they were. They pinched them right off the bat, the Army did, whether they got them at home or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And Grant and Farrell and myself and a few more, Don Tutty and Kelly and a few more, we all legged it out of that headquarters as quick as we could when they surrounded the place.
Sure.
And Grant, of course, was with Farrell when they came into the meeting that we were at, Kelly and I and Ray Rainbolt, up in the Sexton building in Bob Kramer's office. And they were the two that were the spokesman for the union that went with, I don't know, Governor Olson or whoever, when they got the guys out of the stockade that day. And Grant played a very essential role during the strike. And he was never, in my opinion, in the stockade. I don't think Carl was. And when the strike was over, of course, and the reorganization of the union had to be done, Grant was elected recording secretary. Farrell was the secretary treasurer. Frozig and Bill Brown remained. And they elected three trustees. I think it was Scogie and Ray and Harry DeBoer, Ray Dunn. Then we had a tremendous amount of support during the strike by the unemployed people. And after the strike was over, the union was hopelessly in debt. We still had the guys on the job to get back. We had the families to take care of that were injured or killed as a result of the strike. And Grant was one of the full-time organizers on the staff. And shortly after the strike was over, we were faced with the problem of where to go and what to do and what the perspective was for the immediate future. And Grant was, of course, a great theoretical thinker, too. And when it was decided in the union that the people that assisted us in the strike, and we termed them the federal workers, they were working for one of these ERA, WPA job, we called them federal workers, that what the union should attempt to do was organize those people and meet their demands, attempt to meet their demands. Now, these people had all sorts of things. There was lots of people that were direct welfare recipients. The amount of money that they were earning wasn't able to meet their needs, and they had to get supplementary help here and there, lots of them. So it was decided that the union would endeavor to formally organize a federal workers section of the union. And that, for the most part, the people who were actual federal workers would be the activists in that group. But it had to have some central direction, and it had to have some general outline and knowledge of what the aims were. So Grant was nominated to the post of working with and developing that section of the union. Now, we looked upon the organizing the federal workers as a group of oppressed workers that needed help, that had helped us. And this, as I've told you many times, is what perplexed the employers. Where did they get them people?
Mm-hmm.
Now, contrary to what the thinking in many unions, you got to have a book in the union, and your 42nd cousin had to be a member of the union in order you to walk the picket line and to help out. We took a different position.
Yes, yeah, certainly you did.
And we took a position that the oppressed worker had a beef. And that he was a human being and he was entitled to everything that goes with the dignity and what is in store for a person who is on this world and needs a decent way of life. That was basically the position of Ray, Carl, Dobbs, and the group around Minneapolis, that, and I'm proud to say that I was in that group. And I have no regrets over the position and the role that we played there. So Grant was given the chore of being responsible for the federal workers section. Now, he had assistants there. There isn't any question about it. But the general overseeing of that job was a tremendous task, and I don't know who could have accomplished it better than Grant. I actually don't. Now, he had the assistance of Farrell's wife. There was women that had to be involved. We had a big ladies' auxiliary.
Marvella Shaw?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, and Clara Dunn helped there too, my colleague, when we stop of it now. And there were others. We had a very essential ladies' auxiliary. And of course, that was helpful to us during the strike.
What kinds of things did they do?
Oh, my goodness. They done everything. They were around the strike headquarters, and they were leading campaigns, and they'd appear in demonstrations,
mm-hmm.
and they'd, women problems they were able to discuss with other women.
Mm-hmm.
And they would talk to them, and they'd involve the wives of the strikers and point out to what it was all about. And they were doing all sorts of things. I just can't say it. They weren't just cookie bakes, you know,
mm-hmm.
or quilting parties. They were more, they would organize women to lead a demand at the city fathers, or they'd appear here and protest. And, I don't suppose they were completely unique. They probably were familiar with the role of Mother Jones and a few more of the other
sure.
Women activists in this country.
Sure.
And I would say that their role paralleled Mother Jones's role, if you're familiar with her career,
mm-hmm.
More so than they did organizing PTA festivals or cookie bakes or Girl Scout jamborees.
Well, in those times, with the situation being as desperate as it was, they couldn't waste their time on such things.
No, no, and they didn't. And had they had the time, they'd have put it to better use. So, anyway, that's... So, I think... because, you see, the thinking was in that group that women are equal. There wasn't any idea of second-class citizenship. Hence, we wouldn't have organized the federal workers because they weren't employed on the job. We took the position they were human beings, and like I outlined to you earlier, that was it. And women had their fair share. They were to be represented and to be heard and to be considered and had an equal right in the spoils, you know. So then there was another fellow there, that a Jewish fellow named Max Geldman, and Ed Palmquist, and they were more or less the... Well, I don't want to use the expression Jimmy Higgins boys because it wasn't that degree.
You've used that term a couple times, but I'm not exactly sure.
Jimmy Higgins?
Yeah.
Well, Jimmy Higgins is a name, I think, that come out of the old Tammany Hall. I don't know about its origin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a guy that was given the job of peddling the handbills and sweeping the hall and running down here to do all them little trivial jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to dig around here and see where the Jimmy Higgins expression can be more adequately expressed for you, because you're so concerned in it. But I identify it with a guy that does the little small work.
Mm-hmm.
We got to have somebody down there to peddle handbills today. We got to have a guy over here do this today. We need somebody to go down to the railroad station and carry the baggage, or those little jobs. Somebody got to meet somebody here or that. I define them as Jimmy Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
Ed and Max, if we could use the name, would be more in the what's known today in the industry as the business agents. They responded to the grievance. They were more or less the vocal spokesman, along with Marvel and Clara and was a couple of other gals, and I can't remember their names now. They'd come to me. And I think Mrs. Hork, for a while, Moe's wife, was active.
She did mention that when we spoke with her.
Yes, I think she was in that. And there was another woman, I think, a Mrs. Featherstone, but I think there was some kind of clash of personalities there. But as I recall...
Mrs. Hork told us that she would come down to the union headquarters and her mother would take care of the children, but it used to upset her mother very much that she would work at the headquarters, but she did it anyway.
Yes, she was there, you know. And after the strike was over, in the immediate post-strike period, the Ladies Auxiliary played a magnificent role, because it was all sorts of things that had to be done. You know, the women were distraught, and there was consolation needed, and there was a lot of adjustments to make after a whole summer, you might say, of strike, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a... and you ask women done, they went down and they made runs on the conditions. You earlier asked about medical care.
Mm-hmm.
They went down and they had, well, I guess what today we'd call sit-ins, but then they were kind of more or less demonstrations about beefing up the health care and straightening out some of the methods where they were given kind of a short shift on medical problems and the like of that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And now Grant, he kind of overseed that whole thing. He was responsible. And the Federal Workers Section, to use the common name, become a viable part of 544 life, 574, the Federal Workers Section.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we distrained the use of the word unemployed. There was a question, because there was a group in Minneapolis called the Minneapolis Central Council of Unemployed Workers.
Your brother mentioned that to me.
Mm-hmm. And for the most part, these were former craftsmen, worked in one of the craft unions or members of the union.
Mm-hmm.
And they had formed a group among themselves, because most unions, when you become unemployed and you got out of work stamps in your book, why, you're just kind of a non-person anymore till you get a job again. And so the Unemployed Council was set up independently in its origin, I believe, from the union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think any union sponsored it. And they were in existence some time. I don't know their exact origin either. But they were active. And we didn't want to take away from them their right to be identified. And at the same time, there was a group around the country that was being organized called Workers' Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
So we settled on the name of the Federal Workers Section. That way there wouldn't be no misinterpretation, Workers' Alliance, Unemployed Council. And as I recall from memory, I'd say the overwhelming group that was in the Unemployed Council became part of the Federal Workers Section, and those that didn't want to be voted with their feet. And I think the Unemployed Section, or the Minneapolis Central Council of Unemployed Workers, kind of faded out of the scene. But they later on, you know, and now to prove the effectiveness of Grant's work and his ability there to chart more or less the day-to-day course, was the big WPA strikes and the big demonstrations that were held in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And they were active on the on those scenes.